Welcome back to the Technicast. We have another guest today, Meredith Moravati. She's the executive director at Dryad. She started there back in 2014. Previously, she was vice president of membership and fellowship at the American Society of Echocardiography. And she also spent time working at Oxford University Press. And funnily enough, she was also a realtor at Franklin Street Realtor right here in Chapel Hill, down the street from us. Thank you again for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So I guess our first question is just kind of what is Dryad and kind of how was it started and what's its sort of mission?
Sure. So Dryad is a digital repository. And as such, what we do is we serve data that's associated with scholarly literature. We have a background and a history with academic libraries. We grew out of somewhat out of the library space. Our architect, our senior architect who developed the technology for Dryad and built on some open technology to create Dryad, came from university IT sort of environment. So in terms of archiving and safeguarding data and making it usable and discoverable for the future, is our focus. In 2009, Dryad started essentially with a few data packages and a sort of a young governance model. It wasn't quite a nonprofit at that time, but it did start to ingest data and partner with journals to integrate their journal manuscript submission system with the Dryad data submission system. And then in 2011, Dryad formally turned into a nonprofit with a board and organizational members and the governance that comes with a nonprofit. And this origin was around the very important joint data archiving policy, which was in 2011, also known as JDAP. And that was an archiving policy that was developed by about 11 or 12 journal editors. And they created this policy to require data for these journals, and Dryad was the preferred architecture or the infrastructure at the time for that.
Okay, great. Changing gears slightly, where did the name Dryad come from? And then how does it fit in with the data repository?
That's a great question. So for local vores, the Dryad, one of the reasons why Dryad was a good name fit is because of the meetings that started Dryad. The visionaries behind Dryad were academics associated with a variety of locations, but some included some of these local institutions in the Chapel Hill, Durham area, Duke University, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and NC State. And so, of course, scientists can't come together and discuss innovation without a coffee shop. So the required location was Dryad, which is local coffee shop. So the name was a play on that. Mm-hmm. But the name actually is more specifically a combination of the word for a mythological Greek tree nymph. And Dryad's origin was in the evolution and life sciences. And so tree has a significance for this field. So evolutionary or phylogenetic trees are branching diagrams that show relationships among various species. So the tree nymph had sort of a couple of different layers of significance and then a similarity with the coffee shop because science is coffee.
So you kind of already have touched on this a little bit, but how do you guys curate the information that Dryad provides for people?
Sure. So basic curation is an essential element that Dryad provides, and one of the things that Dryad does a little bit uniquely compared to other repositories. A variety of repositories do different levels of curation. Some actually do real deep curation. As a matter of fact, the UNC Odom Institute partners with a particular journal to replicate studies. So there's a real variety of what people will do for curation. But in most repos don't actually curate data. What Dryad does is we'll perform some basic checks on the data. We'll make sure the files are viewable. We'll make recommendations to stay away from proprietary file types so that users later on can download files and use them. Also file sizes to make recommendations on file size so that they'll be easy to download and easy to use. We'll look for good metadata to help describe the data, because data is not going to be useful unless it's both human understandable and machine readable. So the metadata is essential. Proper metadata is essential for discovery. We also do things like helping with versions. So, for instance, if a paper is published and there's associated data with that, and then a researcher comes out and says, you know what, this paper has an error, and then maybe a correction is produced in the paper, and if the correction needs to be made on the data set, we will actually version out the older data set and replace it with a newer, so that you can follow the tree of sort of what happened with the data and follow that self-correcting nature of science. So our curators will do that. More and more, we're actually seeing data come to Dryad that has human subject information. So we are a great safeguard against publishing data that has too many personal identifying information for an open repository. So we'll make recommendations on how to remove some of the identifying information, or make recommendations in terms of suggesting another repository if it's better to safeguard the data somewhere that's not going to be under an open data policy, because all data in Dryad is fully open and fully available, and you don't have any hoops to jump through in terms of downloading and accessing that data.
Have you had any problems with data from Dryad not being properly cited in other works? So are there other pirated repositories who are trying to do something like Dryad is doing?
So that's an interesting question. There's actually kind of two questions sort of in that one question. So I'll kind of unpack it a little bit. So data citation is a really important question. And one of the questions and topics that I spend a lot of time talking to journal partners about work in this area. The short answer with data citation is that it's a growing sort of area. Academics already have a custom of citing sources. So the expectation to cite sources is fairly ingrained in academia. But how do you cite data is a particularly challenging question. In some cases, it's straightforward. And in other cases, for instance, if you're collecting data from different sources and creating a new data set, and then how do you cite those? That can get more and more complicated. The short answer is that citing data is a newish practice. So we're seeing more and more of this, but we don't have a great amount of examples quite yet. The expectation of actually doing this is gaining popularity. There is a lot of work in a variety of different areas and a lot of different groups who are spending time creating principles and standards around things like citation practices. Force 11 is a group that's been working in this area, and I believe, I might date it wrong, but I believe in around 2014 or 2015, they came out with the data citation principles that has been adopted by a lot of publishers and a lot of societies. So, having these groups gather experts from different fields and then develop standards and then pushing those out to the field is something that's happening, and Dryad's very much involved with that. In some cases, we're actively helping to craft them. In other cases, we're providing advice or just watching or participating. So that citation is new and something that we're encouraging. At every time you look at a data package on Dryad's website, you'll actually see an abstract, and you'll see the data files, and then you'll see citation on how to cite the article that the data is associated with and how to cite the data. So we provide that guidance in all of our pages. In terms of, I think it was pirating repositories. So all the data in Dryad is open. So we have no requirements or restrictions on reuse. In fact, the Creative Commons Zero license, CC0, was specifically chosen for Dryad. Interestingly, when Dryad started, the license was not CC0, but we made the switch very quickly thereafter. And CC0 was crafted specifically to reduce any technical or legal impediments to the intentional or unintentional use of data. In most cases, CC0 doesn't even affect the legal status of data, because in most countries, facts in and of themselves are not eligible for copyright. So the issue of pirating is sort of a non-issue. We encourage all of the data in Dryad to be downloaded and reused at will. And that this society norm of providing credit and crediting others and, you know, and citing your sources, it's not, you know, the CC0 is in effect, but it doesn't alleviate the expectation that an academic would cite their sources.
So you kind of talked about how Dryad's sort of like it's a new type of field with this data repository. How are you kind of measuring the company's success moving forward with sort of the collection and curation? And to go along with that, with open access being such a new thing among journals and journal societies, do you see Dryad really being tied to that sort of growth in open access?
I think, to address the open access question first, I think that open data, the open data movement, has a lot of things in common with open access. So the open access movement was started by, you know, researchers who, you know, were blocked from a paywall of trying to get research, trying to get information. Funders now require frequently that a federally funded project is published in an open access journal, because they don't want taxpayers or others to have to pay for something that taxes have already paid for. And in these cases, open data has some things that are very much in alignment with open access. And so oftentimes if I go to a publisher and they're an open access publisher, they already get a certain amount of the open discussion. I don't have to explain to them that, you know, we're worried about pirating or scooping or things like that. They've already kind of sort of understood those questions and found a solution for them. However, the movement for open data is actually much, in my opinion, much more serious than open access, because what happened with the movement for open data is that researchers were able to find the paper and the arguments in the paper, but they couldn't link over to the data that's associated with it. They couldn't verify it. They couldn't dig into it and ask more questions about it. So it wasn't a matter of just the data being behind a paywall. Actually, it was a matter of the data not being available and possibly even disappearing. We found that as papers age, that, for instance, if you're a journal that says we'll provide data upon request, that as papers age, the likelihood of finding that data will fall by 17% every year, which means that that data will just disappear. So that's kind of that's a very serious issue. Not that open access isn't, but it's not just the paywall. Yeah. It's that it might just go. So that's something that we think is, you know, is very important. And our open access publishers, you know, certainly do kind of understand it. You know, in terms of metrics for success, you know, I think that's kind of evolving, but we have seen quite a lot of growth. So in 2016, we published 10% more data packages than the year before. And in 2015, we published about 40% more data packages than the year before. So growth is inconsistent, but it's increasing. So that's one metric we look at. Another is that we partner officially with about 100 journals, but we have data associated with over 560 journals. So we watch those numbers. We just passed our mark in January of hosting more than 50,000 different files. So we look at those things. We also look at things like Twitter followers. You know, Twitter's a really interesting space and a great way to communicate with individual users. I spend more time reaching out to organizations and less time reaching out to individual researchers, but Twitter allows us to continue that data conversation and promote data that we have and to expand the idea of what should be saved, what should be archived, and expand that idea for researchers. They might have made the assumption that genomic data should certainly be saved, but they might forget the CSV files or the images or the other things that actually also support their arguments in the paper. And so we're seeing through our expanded conversations on Twitter and the increased number of followers that we get more and more that people are kind of, you know, they're getting a better understanding of what ought to be archived. And so we look at those metrics as well.
What about how do traditional publishers see Dryad? Do they see you as a competition or as a potential collaborator?
Definitely collaborator, but it really isn't it isn't really traditional versus OA. Mm-hmm. It's actually more field specific. So each field's data and requirements for data are going to be a little different. So for instance, in social sciences, they'll have a lot more human subjects data and a lot more reservations about making it openly available and even publishing it at all in some cases. Whereas in evolution and life science, it was a new idea in 2011. And now if you don't link your data publicly and even make it open under CC0, you could very well be shamed on Twitter. And that was not the case in 2011. So it sort of depends on the field. So when I talk to people in microbiology and in evolution and in life science, they get it, they want to do it, and they're trying to figure out how to, you know, how to make time for it. But when I'm talking to different fields, the impetus might be different. I think all publishers are looking to help researchers with mandates from funders, with requirements from institutions, and offer more value to their services. And providing an easy way for researchers to archive and save and preserve their data for future reuse is another way to provide value. So we've got traditional journals and open access journals that work with Dryad equally.
So you mentioned that Dryad is very dedicated to the open data movement. Mm-hmm. Do you see more repositories like Dryad that might be appearing here in the future? Do you see sort of a trend among more emerging?
Sure. So Dryad's origin was pretty early, and at that time there weren't many others that are doing it in that space, and now there are more that are doing similar things. Zenodo is an example that's a well-used and well-respected repository. Mendeley Data was one as well that is now an Elsevier product, and Figshare, of course, is one as well that came out shortly around the time that Dryad started. I'm also often, or someone from Dryad is often invited to participate in workshops that are, again, field-specific. When a field is thinking about, you know, we have this particular data need, maybe it's materials and not just data, so they're trying to figure out how to actually safeguard materials, and they're trying to think about whether or not they want to create their own field or a specialized repository or evaluate if there are repository and infrastructure out there that they can already use, there will often be workshops around these topics, and Dryad or myself will be invited to provide some feedback on what we've seen and those kind of things. I do see it. I also see that institutions are doing a variety of things in this space, and that seems to be increasing. There's certainly some university libraries that are already well-placed and do a large, real variety of data support. And then there are other institutions that, you know, focus on just archiving support from their actual constituents and aren't so worried or concerned with making data open. They're more just sort of preserving the data that comes out of their institution. But I see that, I feel that libraries are expanding in this space as well, because they already have some of the infrastructure, perhaps. They may or may not already have some of the IT support or could tap into it. And they're certainly the place where researchers would go and ask questions about managing data and how to properly store digital objects for the future.
What kind of challenges do you see for Dryad in the coming years?
So, I mean, there's quite a few. You know, this is, even though Dryad's been at it for a little bit, it's still a relatively new field, and there's areas that are moving and still developing. I think one is to balance our work in curation, for instance, checking for human subject data, and balancing the efficiency, the need to be efficient. We don't want to put too many requirements or increase burdens on researchers. They're already burdened by a lot of other requirements. But we want to more provide tools to safeguard their data and enable an adherence to journal policies or or funding policies or increasing mandates for open data practices. So I think there's a real balance that we'll need to continue. I think that what we'll start doing is encouraging researchers to be more thoughtful when they're describing their data. The two top areas that researchers expect, if they think that data is going to be reviewed before the article is published, they expect that the methods will be reviewed, you know, the methods that should be properly described so that it can someone might redo their experiment, and that there'll be proper metadata in place. Dryad's mission has been to provide infrastructure and make more data openly available and link back to publishers, and that continues to be. But I think we'll start to encourage researchers to take more care and give more feedback to them about what kind of metadata we think should be in place, or make some recommendations on some method enhancements, or suggest that they upload new files that describe certain things, or even provide the code that they have along with their data package. And we're starting to give more guidance. So finding that balance of providing more guidance and more customer service, and not, you know, not overdoing it, not, you know, allowing the researcher to make the decision. They know what their field needs. They know what their arguments in their paper, you know, they know what they need to support. So I think that balance is something that we'll always be working on.
Okay. And kind of using, I guess, Dryad maybe as like a microcosm for it, what's your sort of take on the current political climate, I guess, globally, and how it's sort of impacting the science and how it's impacting the sort of way Dryad is working right now?
That's tough. You know, that's a tough question. I mean, there's so many things to say about that. You know, Dryad is intentionally an international organization. Half of our board members are outside of the United States. And science is an international topic. It's not a topic with any natural border. So, discouraging the free flow of ideas across borders is always going to have a negative impact on science and specifically on Dryad. So that's one part. You know, I'm actually not a technical researcher person. I'm actually a history person. And so I see this in context, and it both makes me feel a little bit more reassured that we've faced similar issues before, but also scared in the same way that in the past these kind of issues have hurt people. You know, every administration switch will have new websites and closed departments. But I'm also very worried about the populist tendencies to distrust government and to prefer corporations for security, which seems to be something that is not special to the U.S. right now, that you can actually see this in other countries. And in my opinion, this does not hold up well for society or for science. So in terms, for example, in the EPA, it's very scary that the current tide is to remove what's seen as barriers for corporation and economic growth, but what will ultimately be the result will be less safe water, less free information, not relying on information that we already have, wasting money on doing new experiments when we have that information already. You know, you don't need to be a history person to know that when corporations are left with very little accountability, people are exploited, and that we end up with less accountability. And it's very hard to wrap your head around the agreed idea that we need more transparency in science and trust in science, and how we do that is to make, one way that Dryad is doing that is making data open with what we're seeing in our local and our federal and even international governments right now. I find that really troubling.
Boy, you dipped into my last question there, which is, in what ways is Dryad helping increase public trust in science? So I guess, so now that we've talked about, you know, the things that are scary on the horizon, you know, what are the glimmers of hope and the positive elements in there?
You know, I think the glimmers of hope is that, for the most part, people want to make decisions based on information. And we've had a lot of conversations recently in the U.S. about news and fake news and lies and that kind of thing. And, you know, at the end of the day, information is going to be information, and that when you're able to reproduce science or reproduce an experiment, you know, that is the scientific principle, really, isn't it? That this research will, you know, the experiment will perform the same over and over again in some of these instances. So I think continuing to make this science available and continuing to safeguard and preserve it. You know, I've seen a meme recently about librarians being, you know, the real innovative, you know, at the first front of safeguarding people's rights. And I feel like that's kind of that's very true, that if we're able to preserve the information we have and to make it available for anybody who wants it, and that, you know, we're preserving the provenance of where did that data come from, then what happened to it, and then what discovery came out of that, you know, you're able to really see discovery and science in action. And I think that that'll come back, and I don't think we've lost it. I think we're just in this transition that's very challenging and very frightening, and that we'll continue to stand our guard and make data available and open up science for as many people who can access it, and that, you know, people who are coming up and coming in, new scientists who are entering school right now, they're going to remain curious. They're going to remain coming up with new and more questions, and the data will only help them solve or think about those questions. And it's, you know, it's never going to go away. So that's super important. And I think that gives all repositories also an added requirement or need to make sure that their data is going to be safeguarded in the long, long, long term. And one way that Dryad's working on doing that is a partnership with a dark archive, so that if Dryad disappeared one day, the data would still be there and the links would still work the same way. So that's something that we're working on right now, and we'll be revealing soon a new partnership, which we're excited about. And also our sustainability plan. You know, if we 100% relied on government funding, I'd be very nervous about that right now. And I'm very thankful that Dryad actually isn't. We have a mixed business plan where we allow individuals to pay. We encourage journals to pay. We have a new pilot that's just ending where we're allowing a funder to pay directly for data deposits. So we've got a real diverse economic base in terms of how you can participate. And that is going to provide us with security to make sure that the data is available in the long term. So I think those things are essential to make sure that, you know, the public's trust will only be enhanced in science, and that this sort of so-called anti-intellectual movement will not gain much traction.
Well, with that very nice uplifting ending, I think we'll end it on that note. Thank you so much, Meredith, again, for coming by and answering our questions. Is there anything else you'd like people to know about Dryad? Anything you guys have coming up in the future other than the partnerships you just mentioned?
You know, there's always, we're sort of a lean technical group. You know, there's always new plans that we've got rolling out. You know, Dryad is a membership organization, and as such, we rely on organizational members such as societies or publishers or institutions, anyone sort of these stakeholders in scholarly communication, which can be a grand, you know, number of organizations. So we're always looking for more members and more stakeholders to get involved. Dryad's board comes from all these areas, and these are the people that guide us and our mission. So I would just say that, you know, I think supporting nonprofits and kind of educating yourself about the different vendors that you're working with and asking them about these sort of long-term plans is something that I'd encourage people to do and your listeners to do. And I think Dryad will be having a webinar later this spring in May. It's not been announced yet. And we'll be talking about some of these issues. So when I learn more about the details and have more content, I'll let you all know.
Great. Thank you.
Yes. Once again, this is Meredith Moravati. Thank you so much for coming, Executive Director of Dryad. And for more information on Dryad, you can visit the link through our website. And again, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Great. And as one final note, in the immortal words of Ray Bradbury, you only fail if you stop writing.